Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a quick question for you. What would you ask Rudy Giuliani if you got a hold of his cell phone number and he actually picked up?
Oh my God, we got to talk about this. It's the biggest story in the news, of course. It's my blockbuster one-on-one conversation with Rudy Giuliani. Take a look. So I swung by the Grand Havana Room and they mentioned you have some kind of outstanding upholstery cleaning bill. Sounds like you sat on that chair for 4 minutes and the stain was like nothing they've ever witnessed in this world or any other.
I don't remember breaking a chair here.
Yeah, I don't think it was breaking so much as a stain that they were worried about.
A stain?
Yeah. Now that brings us to tonight's installment of Staingate.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was my guest today, RJ Fried, prank calling Rudy Giuliani as cartoon news anchor James Smartwood on Tuning Out the News. Before RJ created Tuning Out the News, he actually worked behind the scenes at MSNBC on The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. From there, he moved on to The Late Show with David Letterman before launching Our Cartoon President on Showtime, which, like his newest show, is also produced by Stephen Colbert. Of the many political comedy shows on TV right now, Tuning Out the News somehow manages to be the most consistently funny and hard-hitting. So I was just really excited to talk to RJ about how he gets people like Jeffrey Epstein defender Alan Dershowitz and actual members of Congress to sit down and subject themselves to brutal interrogations from the show's cast of cartoon interviewers. If you've never seen Tuning Out the News, you are missing out. But for now, here's me talking with RJ Fried. Well, it's good to see you. I was looking back. We talked over a year ago. It was last April, right when Tuning Out the News was premiering, I believe. And you were just sort of trying to figure out how to do it all from home and during the pandemic at the beginning. And so it was kind of a crazy time for you guys. But yeah, so it's great to talk to you now. But I guess just to start, because we talked a lot about Rudy Giuliani during that interview, that was for a piece in the Daily Beast. So I wanted to see, first of all, do you have any updates on Staingate? Anything to report? Anything going on?
Look, the research department is on two floors of a tower somewhere in Midtown working on it. But no updates on Rudy. Every once in a while, we'll flirt with giving him a call back and seeing how things are going. So far, he hasn't picked up. Something tells me my phone has been, I don't know, maybe he knows who's calling nowadays. But yeah, he's busy, and now it's on to Andrew Giuliani. Now is our main focus.
That's your new target. You got to get his cell phone number. That'd be good.
Yeah, I'll work on that. Yeah, I'll have to bribe some reporters into giving it to me.
I think Rudy has like six different phones, so I don't know which one you got. That's also key.
Actually, now he doesn't have any phones, it sounds like. It sounds like the FBI has all his phones.
Oh, but, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so maybe if you call him now, it'll just go straight to the FBI.
Yeah, he's been good at tuning out the news, and we appreciate his support.
So I feel like sort of the big question for you when it comes to this show is, how do you get people to appear on this show? Because I have no idea why anyone is deciding to be a guest on your show. Not to discourage anyone, but it seems like kind of a crazy proposition. So I'm curious, just at a base level, how do you get people to appear on the show?
We have an amazing booker named Julie Zan, who's been a talent booker / producer for many years, and she's got a deep Rolodex, and she pitches it like she would, I think, any other show. The Colbert Report has really educated the world on how these things go. And so people know you're to be talking to characters. You're the straight person of the scene. You don't have to make jokes. If anything, we just kind of want you to put out good information. So they have that's kind of taught them how to behave in those scenarios. And it's like any other hit. And I have to say, obviously COVID has been extremely horrible for the entire world, but it has done this thing in cable news world where now you can just flip on your computer and you're appearing on a TV show. And so the entry point is much easier now to get guests. So no, we're thankful. We've been very fortunate, and Julie's been amazing.
when looking at all of your guests, I mean, there are a lot of people who are sort of like Democratic congressmen who maybe are a little friendlier. There's a lot of media people, but there are these handful, I think the ones that have been my favorites for obvious reasons are sort of the more adversarial ones that you've done. So I'm thinking about Joe Arpaio, Matt Schlapp was a favorite, Alan Dershowitz was a weird one. So I'd love for you to kind of take maybe one of those or similar as an example and sort of talk about why you wanted to have them on the show, how you convinced them to come on, and then how you prepared to interview someone like that who you know is going to be a little bit more controversial.
We try to pick our spots with those, certainly, because there's, I think the audience has a certain level of stress they're willing to tolerate. And if every episode was like one of those, it would probably be a little much. And at some point we would stop getting guests because they'd be scared that we were going to do it to all of them.
Yeah, you don't really want to be the show that people are too scared to come on, although maybe you do a little bit. It's a hard balance.
Yeah,
right?
We want to be like honest arbiters and have good credibility with our audience. But those interviews you spoke of in particular were, I would say, particularly aggressive. When it comes to people like, well, there is this thing you're probably aware of, which is that people like being on television.
Yeah.
And so that tends to maybe appeal to their worst instincts.
Yeah, Alan Dershowitz fits that bill. I mean, all those people I mentioned probably fit that bill. And yeah, Joe Arpaio was even on Sacha Baron Cohen's show unboxing children's toys. So he really likes to be on television.
He was more than happy to come on to the point where it was almost off-putting. And afterwards informed us that he had a great time and would love to come back, which it makes you want to like, now here's the thing. It's like, you know, we can't make the guests say anything. All we have is our jokes. And so, you know, if you're going to try to like, you're not going to talk Sheriff Joe Arpaio into a different point of view. All you can really do is use jokes and evidence to show the audience as much as possible what we're looking at here.
Now, I don't want to seem like a hokey idealist, but can we look forward to a day where people will take the biggest shits imaginable on your grave?
Take the what on the grave?
You know, just giant dumps, you know, big poops.
I have no idea about that, what the question is that you have.
I'm going to start saving up now for my bouquet of doo-doos.
Oop, I just remembered that life is fleeting and it's not worth wasting another second haranguing a monster, no matter how much he deserves to live by himself on salt flats. So let's wrap it there. Thank you to our analysts and guest, Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
Joe, let me just say, for all the bad you did, at least you got to dress up like a sheriff.
Good night, everyone.
And also not fall into the trap that we make fun of other media outlets for doing, which is honestly can be pretty lazy about how they approach guests and issues, or they treat guests according to, you know, trying to protect their access. We make fun of them for that, so we cannot fall into the same traps of being lazy when you approach these things. So we take our journalistic credibility, even though we're not journalists, or I guess our comedic credibility, very seriously.
Yeah, I mean, can you talk more about that? Because you're such a student of media, I feel like, and you worked in it in the past, which I want to get to later. How do you think about that when you watch? Do you spend a lot of time watching cable news and other shows? And what are they doing that you're really trying to avoid?
Well, ultimately, tuning out the news is such an exhaustive production process that I have barely time to do anything but stare.
I'm impressed you have time to talk to me right now.
We had to shift some things around. We made it work because we love you, Matt. Look, I was in that chair before. I was a segment producer for The Last Word, Lawrence O'Donnell. I have one memory of one time it was during the Libya conflict where we were, I forgot what it's called, where you shut down any air capabilities, or it was basically
a no fly zone.
No fly zone. And we were in this kind of like war coverage thing. And you know, you're watching the wire come in and you're getting all this information about deaths here, injuries here, battles here, and it's very incoherent. It's truly fog of war situation. And I'm sitting there typing into iNews, which is the software those place cable news uses. And I remember just typing something that as far as I could tell, the best of my ability, what was happening. And then like 10 seconds later, seeing Chris Jansing say it and thinking that's way too much power to put in the hands of me, an idiot, sitting in a chair in, you know, Rockefeller Center. There is this thing that happens when you see something on TV that there's just this automatic legitimacy because of the production values and how good it looks. And these are reputable people. And it really most of the time is a charade. And part of the inspiration behind Big News was just that there was that one time when Brian Williams, where a guest did the math on how much money Bloomberg had dumped into his campaign and how it could help people if had they just like donated it. And they were off by, she gave the number, and they were off by like 1,000,000%.
You see it as a possibility if he wants to spend $1 billion beating this guy, he could do it.
Absolutely. Somebody tweeted recently that actually with the money he spent, he could have given every American $1 million.
I've got it. Let's put it up on the screen. When I read it tonight on social media, it kind of all became clear. Bloomberg spent $500 million on ads, U.S. population 327 million. Don't tell us if you're ahead of us on the math. He could have given each American $1 million and have had lunch money left over. It's an incredible way of putting it.
But the world kept turning and like no one knew. So you watch that and you're like, there's definitely a discrepancy between, there's a gap between what people think of cable news or news in general and what is actually going on. And we're trying to educate them of that.
That's
gap.
One thing that I love that you nail so well on tuning out the news, which is if you say anything in a certain news tone of voice, people will just take it. And you see your guests do that over and over again, where they barely react to the most outrageous thing being said to them by this cartoon because it's being said in a certain tone.
Yeah, I'm surprised sometimes the guests will nod along to an insane point. Yeah. And we're like, are you sure about that? All right, we'll hear it. But I should also mention, like, in order to know what's wrong with something, you have to know it deeply. And so unless you're like, I tell people who are coming up, like, you got to read the New York Times and you got to read the full article, Washington Post, you know, there's great journalists out there. But if you're just reading the headlines, you're not getting the full shape of the issue, and you need to understand the full shape of the issue to be funny about it.
Yeah. And if you're just watching cable news, you're also probably not getting the full story.
No, here's what I compare it. MSNBC, for example, like, I don't think they're lying, but it's like, if I were to tell you about a great white shark and I were to describe it as this majestic creature that goes throughout the ocean and left it at that, you would say, wow, great white sharks sound great. If I left out the part about how they, whatever, eat humans. And so, like, I'm not lying to you, but I'm definitely omitting some pretty key information. And that sort of narrative goes MSNBC, Fox News, CNN, whatever it is, that's going to exist in some form.
The other one that I wanted to ask you about, one, because it's the most popular interview clip on YouTube from your show, and also because it's someone who I've worked with before, is Rick Wilson, who used to host another podcast for The Daily Beast, The New Abnormal. He's now on semi-permanent leave. And that's one that got a ton of attention, I think, because he was seen as someone who might have been friendlier to your show or more politically aligned with the show. But you guys really went at him hard. I'm curious, why did you want to do that? And what was that experience like?
We wanted to do it because the discrepancy between what people thought about the Lincoln Project and what we thought was the truth about the Lincoln Project was so far apart then. This was before all the grifting accusations and obviously the sexual harassment accusations came
out
as well. No, it was not part. Yeah, we had no idea. And it was so clear that there was a mass misunderstanding of what this was. And I remember talking to Zach Smilovitz and Mike Leach, who are co-EPs on the series, who are head writers as well, as doing research and just being like, God, screw these guys. Like, this is really messed up what they're doing. And they're, you know, I had learned from my MSNBC days how to go into FEC docs and actually look at the numbers. And I specifically remember doing this for Palin Pack and seeing their overhead was like 95% and thinking that was just ludicrous. And, you know, you looked at the Lincoln Project numbers and they were very out of balance with what I think people expect when they donate a dollar, how much was actually going to what they thought it was going to. And so I think we caught Rick by surprise in that. And
I think
you can kind of
so.
See, yeah, you can kind of see over the course of the segment, he's slowly realizing that we've really done our research and we're not happy with what we saw. And by the end, he's completely very pissed off.
Let's talk about how the Lincoln Project spends all those Maddow viewers' money. Here is how much three other top liberal super PACs spend on operating expenditures compared to total disbursements. In other words, the percentage spent on overhead costs, including salaries over their lifetime. Senate Majority PAC spends 16.8% on overhead. Unite the Country is 14.75%, and American Bridge 21st Century is 46.7%. What do you think the percentage is for the Lincoln Project?
Well, you're going to see our new report coming out in July, which represents our first major period in our campaign that wasn't involved in startup costs and acquisition costs and data costs. And you're going to see that we are putting about 85 cents of every dollar into voter contact.
85% with 15% going to overhead would be a lot better, because right now it's the opposite. 11% goes to independent expenditures and 89% goes to overhead.
89.3% on overhead sounds like a lot, but I can't get into the right headspace to make a 10-second ad without wolfing down endangered mollusks in a titanium catamaran with my Bush administration buddy.
Yeah, you can tell his face really, really drops throughout the interview, and by the end he basically is not even responding to anything. Is he the guest who's been the most upset after a taping, would you say?
There have maybe been one or two others that I will not say in public, but he was definitely the most on camera upset, and I think realizes the papers were already signed and he had the footage, and he was in trouble. I mean, that traveled from left to right, political spectrum-wise, like far right to far left. And I'm glad we were part of the education of what was going on with that organization. Then ultimately all that stuff came out, and then there was all these studies saying like they didn't change any votes. You pick your spots when you see such a, you know, there's people who are out there who are, I would say, like they're already clowns, they're already entertainers, and you're not gonna, and I think people know that, and so you're not really, there's only so much you can really do. But this was one where the perception was so off, it seemed like.
We mentioned Andrew Giuliani as a potential guest. Are there other big targets that you have been chasing this whole time, or people that you really want to get on the show that you haven't been able to convince yet?
I'd love to get more Republicans. They don't seem to want to. I would love to get more Republicans, but we've had some really great, the really cool thing is getting like, we've had some really great CBS News hosts and contributors. You know, we'll get an MSNBC host every once in a while. Yeah. I mean, we'll take who we can get, but yeah, I mean, the more power, the better, especially politicians who actually are the ones making the votes. That's ultimately, I think, the most interesting. But it's also, honestly, I think the best guests are the ones who are actually doing good work out there, because we get to be the idiots and they're actually doing a good thing, and it feels right. That's where the comedy flows the best. And honestly, the shows where you come out feeling the best, because it's like, wow, everyone got to do their role. They got to actually do their good work. We got to be idiots. That's the best version.
It's interesting thinking about having more Republicans on. I'm reminded of there's this sort of this debate about giving people a platform versus, you know, grilling them. And I think it came up a lot. I think Jake Tapper recently said that he wouldn't have anyone on his show who supports the big lie, those kinds of things. Where do you fall on that in terms of, is it more important to have the person on and expose them? Or are you in danger of giving someone a platform?
I would say case to case. I mean, there's definitely guests we've turned down because we didn't want to give them a platform.
Anyone you can name in that category?
There's like the Ben Shapiro, Tommy Lahren, who it seems like might gain more from it than we would. Yeah. Then there's people who, you know, say like Sheriff Joe Arpaio, where we felt like, well, I think we could get our shots in. I don't think we'll have him back, but I think we get our shots in. But I don't like making hard, fast rules on this. I do know that it does seem like Donald Trump's ban from Facebook and Twitter has done some damage to his ability to reach his audience. Deplatforming him has been effective in that way. So for our comedy show, that's the judgment call. Are we doing them a favor? Are we actually, we do think about those things, is do we want this voice out there, or do we think we can put it out there and filter it with our jokes in a way that is effective?
Coming up, RJ reveals how he made the transition from cable news to late night comedy, and tells a truly remarkable story about Triumph the Insult Comic Dog and Chris Christie.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of The Last Laugh is brought to you by Vanderpump Villa, a new reality show starring Lisa Vanderpump, now streaming only on Hulu. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabel, a glamorous estate in the French countryside. Meet the elite staff as they work, live, and play together 24/7 while dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. As they try to provide once-in-a-lifetime experiences for their guests, the staff will need to meet Lisa's high standards. Not everybody has what it takes. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu. If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please hit subscribe. Along with RJ Fried, we have had so many great conversations with comedians who excel at confronting real-life figures, from Sacha Baron Cohen to Jordan Klepper. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love this show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to RJ Fried. So I want to go back a little bit and talk about how you got to this point of making this show. And I guess we can start, as you mentioned, working for Lawrence O'Donnell's show on MSNBC, which is now, I think, more than over 10 years ago you were working there. What was that experience like for you? And was it kind of, I could imagine it being kind of disillusioning in that it led to you doing this show in some way. but was it, how did you feel about it at the time?
Let me start by saying Lawrence O'Donnell might be the smartest person I've ever worked with. And he's extremely sharp. I don't know if I've ever worked with someone who's made me feel stupider, more stupid, in as much as he has in the best way possible. So that was always thrilling to be able to be around him. You learn how to write fast. Obviously, like there's the news is happening at 10 p.m. And so you learn that. You learn that much more about the shape of issues. I think as a comedy writer, there's always, I think comedy people can relate to the feeling of not feeling like your square peg round hole thing, where it's like, I need to be back in comedy world because those people, I think like me and I don't necessarily think like these, you know, people do. So there was that awkwardness.
You were already in comedy when you started there.
Yeah, I actually, you know, I started in Los Angeles and got hooked up with Dave Thomas of SCTV and did a few projects with him, moved to New York. And I actually got the offer to write on 90 Too Many Stars with Robert Smigel. Like the same day I got the offer for the MSNBC job and ended up doing, you know, trying to make both work. But yeah, then there is the disillusionment of, well, I mean, look, it was all good education because I got to learn about how cable news works and those things I was talking about earlier about where it falls short was helpful.
And at some point you made the jump to Letterman's show a few years after that. How did that happen? And why did you, were you eager to go back to a full-time comedy gig?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly was. There was always that, like I said, that feeling of I'm not sure I belong in this environment. And it was a straight up submission to Late Show with David Letterman back when their pretty open submission policy and luckily landed in the right hands. It was great. And I really, that room is unbelievably sharp, or was unbelievably sharp. And so quite a room to walk to walk into. I don't think I had my sea legs or was ready for that level of how quick things were. But yeah, I had to get up to speed real quick. But it was amazing.
Were you mainly working on monologue jokes, or what was sort of your main role during your time there?
So they had a few monologue writers and then the rest. And I was part of the rest, which is about like eight or nine writers. So showing up, pitching bits, what they called extras for the monologue, which is little videotape pieces, sketches for, you know, late in the show and such. And obviously top 10 jokes, ton of top 10 jokes.
The reputation that I remember hearing sort of in Dave's later years is that the writers had almost no interaction with him. Was that your experience? Did you have a relationship with David Letterman?
I talked to him more on stage playing the character of RJ than I did off stage. I respect that it's hard to go out on stage, David Letterman, Lawrence O'Donnell, whoever it is, and be that on and expose yourself that much to an audience every night. And look, these people are wealthy and they're going to be okay. But it's a lot emotionally, and performing takes a lot out of you. And so I'm a very private, introverted person, and I kind of get it. I get the wanting of some kind of space, and I get how that could be so exhausting to have to come out on stage and do that, especially if most comedians are pretty private, introverted people. And so the idea of, I think those people, I mean, like me, if I go to a party within the first 5 minutes, I'm exhausted. So to have to go on stage and run the party for whatever it is, 60, 90 minutes is a lot. And so, yeah, we didn't interact with Dave a lot, but I'm not sure I get it. He's got to be ready to go out and perform.
You mentioned Robert Smigel, who you've worked with a lot over the years, and I'm really interested in your time spent on his the Triumph election specials in 2016, because I thought those were just, that had so much really funny stuff in them. And I got to talk to Robert Smigel on this podcast last year about a lot of this stuff. What was your experience working with him and kind of going around, traveling around with Triumph?
That was amazing. Career highlight easily. I loved every moment of it. Robert is everything that the legends are true. He's so brilliant and so after the best joke possible, relentlessly. It's all true. And so, you know, I grew up, I mean, Sacha Baron Cohen, Stephen Colbert, and Triumph, those were like my idols. And so to get to do that, when the idea of going on the road came up, I begged my wife to let me do it, and luckily she relented. And yeah, it was amazing. I mean, I just like ducking under tables 10 feet from Ted Cruz as Robert had the puppet like right in front, like, that was just the best. I have actually a lot of the footage in the special I recorded on my iPhone right here, and I could show you some raw footage right here. I got raw footage of Ted Cruz signing an AR-15 with a silver marker. Yeah, a lot of that footage was just right off of iPhones because we couldn't get cameras into certain places. But oh, it was the best. I that stuff I just love, and to be close to Robert, who is you can see the genius on camera. He's just relentless, making sure you get good jokes.
Is there a sort of craziest moment or story from those travels with him that sticks out in your memory, whether it's something that made it onto TV or not?
I think, yes, there is. The craziest moment, one of the craziest moments I ever had in my life, and I think Robert has talked about this publicly, so I think, because part of me feels like, oh, this isn't my story to tell, but I think he has told it publicly, which is we were doing the bit where we were the advance team for Chris Christie at the diner. I don't know if you remember that one, but it was basically just, we were preparing a diner for Chris Christie was coming soon. And this is back when there was a lot of fat jokes going around about Chris Christie. Probably would not fly today. So did all these jokes. And then we're in the kind of back where they, you know, have their birthday parties or whatever, trying to figure out some kind of ending to the bit. So this was up in New Hampshire at a diner that he actually frequented near the Manchester airport. And we're sitting there, and then the manager comes in and says, Governor Christie is on his way here. And it was like, what? How? What is going on? We're doing a bit about Chris Christie and he's coming here?
So you were just supposed to interview regular people
just
about
diners.
Chris Christie.
It just pretend like he was coming. We, you know, we knew it was a diner he had been at before, but then coincidentally, he's coming to the diner. What had happened was he was up in New Hampshire campaigning. There was a snowstorm in New Jersey, and so he had to fly down to New Jersey to do his whole photo op thing and, you know, shovel snow like they always do and pretend like they're actually helping. And so he stopped at the diner on the way to the airport. So that bit, if people go watch it, go back and watch that bit, and then, okay, so then we're like, Robert is scrambling, yeah, trying to think of bits for, what are we going to do? Christy's on his way here. And so then the manager comes back and says, he's here. We say, where is he? He's in the bathroom. Perfect. Amazing. So you watch that bit, and Robert comes up with this bit in the moment where Triumph starts acting like a war reporter going in the bathroom. We're going inside to the bathroom. Oh my God. You know, acting like there's bullets flying overhead. And interviews someone who was just in the bathroom with Christy. That was all complete coincidence and real and just mind-blowing.
Okay, sir. I'm talking with a man who has just survived being inside the store that Chris Christie just used. How was it in there? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. Doing all right.
You have anything you want to say to your family? They were very worried.
Okay.
All right. And do you want to describe any of the horror that would you rather not relive it?
I'd rather not relive it. So you gotta see for yourself.
All right. You're very brave.
All right.
Our prayers are with you. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
There goes the real hero of this campaign.
But here's the thing, though, is like, it's only a late night guest story because you can't, we were acting as if we were the advanced team. And then it actually there's nothing we could inject into the bit to convey that to the audience. So the audience had no idea.
Yeah, they just figured it was all set up. You knew he was coming there and you did it. Yeah.
Yeah, we did it. No, it was complete coincidence.
That's so funny.
A strike of comedy lightning. It was unreal.
Yeah, I feel like Robert gets lucky with those things.
Yeah. If you travel relentlessly around, so much of that stuff was brilliant. The Ted Cruz stuff, he's amazing.
So a couple of years after that, you launched Our Cartoon President. And so I'd love to talk about that show a little bit too, which I really, really enjoyed. And did that sort of stem from Stephen Colbert's show in some way? What's the story about how that show came to be?
Yeah, so that show started out as Tim Lukey and Matt Lappin. Tim Lukey comes from an animation background. Matt Lappin is a producer on The Late Show. We're working together on these Trump appearing as a cartoon on The Late Show. At some point, Chris Licht and Stephen Colbert approached him and said, hey, is this a show? They went, they pitched it to Showtime, they bought it. And then they were searching for a showrunner. And it was actually, they called Robert Smigel, and Robert recommended me, and I deeply thank him for it because it's been every source of income ever since. Yeah, and I went in and pitched, you know, here's what I would do with the show, and luckily they went for it, and so we launched the show on Showtime. So it was, I haven't left their side since.
I didn't realize until I was doing the research for this that you played Steve Doocy, Vladimir Putin, and Chris Cuomo on the show.
Yes, I did.
I just like it's a great trio there.
Yeah, I don't know what they have in common. I mean, probably was that show because it was topical and it was also a relentless production schedule. It was truly insane. It was like, at least to start, it was like 2 all-nighters a week, 3 hours of sleep a night, like tops. It was, and I was also, my family was on the West Coast, so I was flying to the East Coast every single week, and it was relentless. So a lot of that is like, hey, can someone hop in the booth and pick this up? And so we actually leaned on the writers a lot who were around these late hours to provide voices. We couldn't get someone who was so big that they wouldn't be available on pretty short notice. So I don't think I'm good at it. Let's put it that way.
You were just stepping in as needed.
Yeah. And also I just have a certain fondness for dumb guys. I don't know if it's my hockey background, but I've been around a fair amount of them. So I maybe get them a little more, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, what I thought was really smart about that show is that you're sort of doing something different from what a lot of other portrayals of Trump would do. And I'm thinking especially of SNL, where it seemed like what they would do is just recreate something that happened on camera almost exactly as it was. And that was sort of the bit. Whereas what you guys were doing was really imagining this whole other behind the scenes life of what was happening with Trump and the people around him, which I think led to a lot more innovation. How did you think about that in terms of how to make someone who's already so outrageous funny? Because that's sort of the challenge when it comes to Trump.
It is absolutely the challenge. And a lot of people reacted negatively to that show because of that, and which I get. Trump was a very, very negative influence on this country and hurt a lot of people. And I could totally understand why some people just aren't ready to laugh at that.
Yeah. Or they feel like turning him into a cartoon is somehow trivializing it. Or is that the feedback that you got?
Yeah. Here's the thing about bad guys is bad guys don't know they're bad, and they think they're heroes. They always do. I'm sure the worst people in the world thought they were, like, Kim Jong-un thinks he's doing the right thing right now. And Donald Trump does too. He thinks he's doing the right thing. And so he is, in essence, a happy warrior. And, you know, that if you're going to, also, if you're going to have your central character, you need your central character of your TV show to have, to be a happy warrior, to have some kind of aspirations, however horrible they may be. Otherwise, it can be pretty exhausting and not really make for a good TV show. And so, yes, that Trump was a happy warrior. We trusted the audience would, you know, listen to the dialogue and understand that, you know, this is, we're by no means Trump sympathizers. And ultimately, we're in an animated world, so we get to do all these kind of, you know, fun plot lines and extensions of what we felt in, was his personality and what that would mean for a plot line. And the weird part about it was that there was like 7 or 8 times where we recorded something, sometimes aired something, and then the actual thing happened. And it was this thing where it's like, it's this thing where if you study the incentives of these people, you know certain things are going to happen and they would happen.
Is there an example of something that you sort of predicted with the show?
There was a ton. I'm trying to think of the most, you know, from the very first episode, Kilmeade speaking out against Trump. And then we had that line in the pilot, which was a large part, like, you know, a large part of me is saying all this stuff, but a very small part of me knows all of this is completely wrong. And like right as it was about to air, Kilmeade actually said something like, I don't know about all this Trump stuff.
What happened at the end of today's Fox and Friends? I only caught the first 170 minutes.
Brian Kilmeade said you're fantastic.
Kilmeade using a 3-syllable word? What are you hiding?
I give Trump's presidency a 10.
10 for me?
Well, I'm going to go with a 9, because a part of my brain is telling me that all of this is wrong.
My God, I've lost Kilmeade.
But then there are things like, oh, like AOC and, sorry, who's, I'm forgetting his name, from the Queer Eye series, we had recorded a bit with him, and then he ended up with AOC, and then like the next week he was like in her office, and it was all these things where, and a lot of times it was like, we couldn't just like scream to press like, oh my God, we had already recorded this thing. It was just like, they would say, oh, they did that thing. And it was like, no, actually we were ahead of that. There was like 7 or 8 coincidences. It was very strange.
So before we end, I want to do our little speed round with you called The First Laugh, which is starts with, what's the first piece of comedy that you remember making you laugh really hard, whether you were a kid or sort of coming up that you really connected with?
I would have to go with The Simpsons. I mean, it was the first time where I felt like, I think as I grew up, I always felt just a little weird, and I was an athlete, and so I was definitely weird for an athlete. Simpsons was speaking my language, though, and there was this sense of community that came along with it. So yeah, I would say they were certainly my first exposure to comedy and laughing really hard.
Yeah. Do you remember the first laugh that you got performing in some way, or maybe even writing in a writer's room, or something that you did that made other people laugh that really made you feel like you could keep doing this?
I do. This is a credit to Robert Smigel. I remember, so I wrote for the first night, Too Many Stars, and there was a bit with Triumph where he was saying some of his other organizations that he was going to sponsor, and it was like, and I got to write some jokes for it. It was like the Larry King smooth testicles for Rimpley Balls Foundation, whatever it was. And that was the first time I'd actually been in a theater and seen, because I didn't come up through theater world. I came up through animation and other scripted comedy. But that was the first time I was actually in a theater and got to see an audience laugh at something I had written. Obviously, Robert's a huge part of getting that laugh. It was very formative, because Robert is one of these people where if you say something funny, he's gonna make it. You know what I mean? And doesn't matter who it comes from, if he thinks it's funny, it's gonna happen. And that's not true in a lot of productions, whether it's laziness or incompetence or whatever it is. Sometimes someone will have a really funny joke and it won't make it to air for whatever reason. Robert finds the funny joke and he gets that thing on the air. Tried to take that to other productions and yeah, like if you hear something funny, like make it happen.
Yeah. Well, that's that thing. I feel like there's the joke that happens in the writer's room that everybody laughs at, but then someone says, well, we can't do that. But then it sounds like he's the person who says, well, what if we did do it?
Yeah, yeah. And it drives producers and prop people and all those people crazy. But no, it's like, I mean, so much of it is like, I mean, even that Rudy Giuliani call, the first tuning out the news, it's like, hey, can we get Rudy Giuliani's phone number? What would that be like? Okay, now we got to call him and we got to record it and we got to do, you know, and like some of it is just like, let's just go for it and see, yeah. And see what
and
happens.
A lot of people would just say, yeah, never mind. But actually, following through is the key.
Yeah, and that's Robert's influence for sure.
Do you remember the first joke that you got on TV on Letterman that either he said or the first bit that you actually got on?
Yeah, because I have the cue card still. It was not great. It was something about some baseball player had been gotten in trouble for some weird infraction, and then I had done, and now MLB will also be trying to clean up, and then the series of kind of increasingly insane infractions that were happening. It was okay. It was fine looking back at it. I mean, so much of when you're in that environment, you learn a lot about hard jokes very quickly and what makes an audience laugh, which is different from a lot of other scripted environments. You're trying to make that audience laugh, the hard joke. So it was okay. But looking back, you know, it's like definitely had to work harder and harder to make better jokes than that for sure.
What about a favorite joke or bit that you got on Letterman?
Oh my goodness. Let me think here. The one that hit the hardest, and I don't know why, was during The View, Barbara Walters talked about her erotic device, let's say, her vibrator. And I had done a bit about that they had started a foundation to try to make sure that human beings didn't have the brain capacity to turn that into an image. For whatever reason, Dave played it in the act two, which was a compliment because that means you're at the desk and it's like there's a lot of pressure built up. It killed, and I have no idea why, but I will take it. It always, you know, like in the best of reel at the end, it made it, and I have no idea why it killed, but it did.
That's great. And then finally, what's the last piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard? Is there someone or something that you want to shout out that you thought was really funny?
I think I'm going to have to go with Sacha Baron Cohen's, the stuff he did with Borat. And I got a chance to sit on that room for Who is America for the Showtime. And it was like, I would have done it for free. I would have paid to be in that room just to be close to him and see his process. But the stuff he's done with Borat still blows my mind. It's just so courageous. It's good. I mean, people like him and obviously Stephen Colbert, what he did with Super PACs and what Robert did with Triumph, man, that is real good comedy, and it's got a lot of courage to it. It doesn't pull its punches. I love that stuff. That's the best.
Is there something that you learned from sitting in on that room with Sacha Baron Cohen that you take with you or apply to what you do now?
Yeah. I mean, he's one of those guys who does, he's got, Robert did this too. Robert came into every, like he walked into remotes with 40 pages of jokes. I mean, just so many jokes ready to go, so prepared. And we're still reading them in the van, getting car sick on the way there, trying to find the best ones. Sacha Baron Cohen is no different. And he's got a roadmap. Okay, if this person says this, I got this. And if they say this, I got this. And look, you know, like there's going to be improvisation, but like you gotta come in super prepared and scout out who's going to be there. What do I say to them? They're probably going to say this. That's definitely happened in tuning, where we knew Alan Dershowitz, because the previous interviews, he's going to say this, and therefore we need to say this. Or Matt Schlapp, we would research, what are they going to say? So we were one step ahead of them. And inevitably, they do it. They have their talking points that they have for each piece of evidence. And it's pretty rare that they surprise you, you know?
But yeah, ultimately, these people are pretty predictable.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, thanks so much for doing this. I'm such a big fan of tuning and everything that you've done. So it was really fun talking with you. And yeah, good luck with everything.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much to RJ Fried for taking time out of his overworked schedule to be a guest on today's show. New segments of Tuning Out the News stream daily on Paramount Plus, with full episodes available to watch at the end of each week. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.